So try this, that the task of prophetic preaching is to draw the people of God into the ongoing history and life of God in the world, to form and empower and maintain a congregation that can participate in God's activity. I say that because when we think about prophetic preaching, we ought not to be preoccupied with rhetoric and posture, but we need to stay focused on the work of forming an alternative community of praise and obedience. So I ask, what was Amos up to? What was Jeremiah up to? I don't think he just wanted them to feel badly. I think he wanted to recruit and mobilize a community of his listeners into a different way in the world. So prophetic preaching is about generativity for an alternative community that is the future of the world. As you know, the call of Jeremiah in Jeremiah 1, it's divine initiative, and Jeremiah didn't want to do it. He said, I'm too young and I can't talk good. And God says to him, shut up. I have come to think that Jeremiah 1:10 is an epitome of the prophetic vocation. God says to Jeremiah, or to Baruch, or however that all works in the very complexity of the book of Jeremiah, I have appointed you a prophet to the nations, and then there are six verbs: to tear down and pluck up, to destroy and overthrow, to plant and to build. There are four negative verbs: to pluck up and tear down, to destroy and overthrow, and there are two positive verbs: to plant and to build. Now it strikes me as important that God does not say to Jeremiah, I want you to talk about plucking up and tearing down and planting and building. No, I want you to do it. You do it, so the book of Jeremiah suggests, you do it by utterance and by gesture, or what scholars call acted symbols. So Jeremiah does stuff too. So the work of Jeremiah and his prophetic ilk are to de-imagine a world of death and to re-imagine a world of life. It's all an act of imagination, because the old world is also an imaginative construct, and the new world. So the twin task, the prophetic task, is to deconstruct the given world and to help people relinquish it. So my psychotherapist says, you want to keep living that way, or do you want to let that go? Well, I sound pretty ambivalent about that. The second task is to construct another world and to help people receive what God is giving. So the prophetic task is the long-term pastoral process of empowering folk to relinquish and to receive precisely the two acts that threaten and frighten and generate anxiety. Good luck with that. So let me give you two New Testament texts. In 1 Corinthians 1:28, Paul's marvelous song about the cross, he has the phrase, in order to bring to nothing the things that are. That's deconstruction, that's relinquishment. And in Romans 4:17, to call into existence things that did not exist. I think it's right, Todd, and I'm no Greek scholar, but I think the Greek is parallel in those two of meon or something like that, being and non-being, to cause what you thought was being not to be in 1 Corinthians and in Romans 4, to cause to be what was not yet, has not yet been. So this is an imaginative construct that has a kind of an ontological undertow to it. We're talking about halting a world and offering another one. So I want to talk about those two tasks. The task of helping the people of God relinquish, pluck up and tear down, destroy and overthrow. In ancient Jerusalem, and I do think that Jeremiah is the most pertinent of the prophets, it reads like it was written yesterday. In ancient Jerusalem, it was to relinquish the unconditional promises to David, which turned out not to be true in 587. It was to relinquish the conviction that God would eternally abide in Solomon's Jerusalem temple, which turned out not to be true. And I suspect even today in contemporary Jerusalem, it is to relinquish the tribal conviction of owning the promised land with violence. That's all got to be given up. We'll try this. What is the relinquishment in which we are now engaged? And I'm going to put it big. It is to relinquish the Western white male straight world of domination. That God is taking that away through the processes of world history, through God's preferential option for the poor, for women, for non-whites, for non-Westerners, for gays, for lesbians, so that not one stone will be left upon another of the way the world used to be. I don't know how to put it any more extremely than that. This represents a threat not only to Western white males who are accustomed to domination, but it is a threat to all the fellow travelers, women, blacks, all kinds of racial, everybody who has become accustomed to organizing social reality in this way. Now, if that sounds radical to you, it isn't very different from Galatians 3:28. For the baptized, no Jew or Greek, no free or slave, no Greek or barbarian, no male or female. What? So we resist the loss. And in the book of Jeremiah, the great resister of the loss is Hananiah. He is a kind of a symbol of denial in Jeremiah 27 and 28. Because what Hananiah says, Hananiah, his name means Yahweh is gracious, for God's sake. Hananiah says, oh, well, we'll return to normalcy in 2 years. The market will be back in 2 years. Don't worry about it. It's going to be right. And all Hananiah is really doing is repeating the theology of Isaiah 100 years later, only it turns out that Isaiah's theology about Jerusalem is no longer pertinent because God has put people in a new time and a new place and in a new crisis. So the Tea Party people yearn for a world that used to be, they imagine, and so much of it seems to rally around the threat of an African-American president who probably isn't an American. On December 17th, as I was beginning to try to think about Hewlett's assignment to me, in South Africa, the old Afrikaners, have any of you been to Johannesburg? Have you seen the great monument at the top of the hill that's got carvings all around it of the Great Trek? The Great Trek is when the Afrikaners started out across South Africa and created a bloodbath of the Zulus. And on December 17th last year, the old Afrikaners gathered at the monument to remember the Great Trek and to remember the great oath to apartheid. It was a stunning kind of happening during our Advent season while we are waiting. So the prophetic task is to penetrate the denial, which they do through outrageous imagery, to name the fear and to communicate the courage and the freedom to face reality over which God governs. What a hard, chilling, thrilling task it is to be in prophetic ministry, to be the agent of God, to transmit courage and freedom, to live in the world that God is taking away and that God is giving. The second task is to receive what God is giving. So there are all of these noble promises about a new heaven and a new earth and a new Jerusalem, which the poets imagined, so that third Isaiah is like, I have a dream, I have a dream, I have a dream. But of course, when Ezra came home, it wasn't like a dream. It was a shambles. And what Ezra had to retool Judaism to do was to accept that God's future was a small colony of Torah keepers. And when he told them that, they rejoiced and they wept and they went out and lived in booths of vulnerability for a fortnight. They came home to their Jewishness. But they did not come home to a great temple, and they did not come home to a great dynasty, and they did not come home to a great city. They came home to be a small colony of Torah keepers. And then you can see in 3rd Isaiah how they are feeling their way about how to organize the new world that God had entrusted to them. So Isaiah 56 is a discussion about how do we practice religion. Now, is not this the fast that I give you to undo the thongs of injustice and bring the poor into your home? That's religion. In Isaiah 56, they had a conference about membership, about who's going to be a Jew now. And the text says, why don't you invite the foreigners in? Why don't you invite the eunuchs in? Why don't you invite the people with messed up sexuality in? Why don't you be welcoming to everybody who wants to keep the covenant and practice Sabbath? And in Isaiah 61, they offered a poem about the new economy. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to proclaim jubilee to the poor. So they struggled to receive the new world that God was giving them that didn't feel so easy for them. It felt like awkward worship, and it felt like threatening membership, and it felt like subversive economics. And they sang about a new heaven and a new earth and a new Jerusalem where there will no more be heard the cry of distress in the streets and no more infant mortality. So what world now must God's faithful people be receiving from God when we now catch on to the fact that the big established church in the United States is really almost over, and we will have to find new ways of being church. And we will have to find in our society new ways of internal democratic inclusiveness. That's what the new debate about Don't Ask, Don't Tell is all about. It's the same debate that they had in Isaiah 58. Who belongs? Who gets in? Who counts? Who's legitimate? And that internal democratic inclusiveness will be matched by a loss, I can hardly say this, by a loss of world domination. I had CNN on this morning, and those young reporters on CNN who know almost nothing were practically having orgasms about the military maneuvers that are going on this morning against the Taliban. And I think those illusionary young people really thought we were going to win something today. But now, people who are in touch with reality will have to reason out what does it mean to be, as Lyndon used to say, an American without world entitlement, without the affluence of the last Reagan years of greed, without privilege, without excessive clout, a new sense of vulnerability, and life in a world that is occupied by others who are unlike us. And perhaps terrorism turns out to be a way in which God is beating the door down that has been closed for so long to so many. The extent to which we cling to the old world that is waning, when we know we can't keep it, drives us to despair. So 2 Isaiah, as I mentioned yesterday, notes these mantras of despair. Isaiah 40, verse 27, my way is hid from the Lord. Isaiah 50, verse 2, my hand is shortened so that I cannot act. Isaiah 49:14, Yahweh has forsaken. We are alone and abandoned in the world because the God of the great entitlements does not seem to be working for us anymore. Good luck with that. So the prophetic task, after you penetrate the denial and bring people to reality, the prophetic task is to penetrate the despair, to honor the shutdown, the emotional shutdown of despair, and to voice hope for the next leg of the journey. I think this is the main theme everywhere in the Bible, because I am talking, am I not, about the relinquishment of Friday and the receiving of new life on Sunday. I'm talking about Friday and Sunday. I'm talking about crucifixion and resurrection. I'm talking about dying and being raised to new life in the world. But the imperial totalism of Jerusalem or of Rome or of Wall Street, totalism, to give a total account of reality, totalism that always tilts toward totalitarianism, a system which is all-explaining, all-encompassing, a system of power and certitude, cannot imagine a relinquishment and cannot entertain the reception of a new world. I don't know how it is among Baptists, but you can spot Presbyterians who are like that in church. See whether you can penetrate my denial. See whether you can prick my despair. See if you can help me move a cubit on the gospel path. I don't think so. And now, prophetic congregations, that means congregations that host this probing, subversive poetry, work against the totalism of the old system. That congregation practices the pastoral dialectic that is congruent with the God who wants us to weep through the night so that joy comes in the morning. I alluded at the outset of my comments this haunting teaching of Jesus in Luke 6. Happy are you if you weep now because you will laugh later. Happy are you if you weep over the world you are losing because you will do an Easter laugh as the new world is given. And then he says, woe to you who laugh now in complacency, for you will weep a damn long time afterwards. And it struck me, I never had seen these amazing words that Todd gave us in James 4:9. It's amazing how stuff converge. Lament, James, lament and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy into dejection, and humble yourselves before the Lord. It is a dialectic that the totalizing system cannot entertain. It is a dialectic of judgment and hope, of plucking up and tearing down and planting and building. It is a dialectic of relinquishing what we treasure and receiving what we resist. It is a dialectic, Kyle, of lament and praise. It is a dialectic of saying, my God, why have you forsaken me? And eventually to be able to say, behold, he who keeps Israel neither slumbers nor sleeps. But what we have to observe is that the church has vetoed the lament. As Kyle observed, we don't have any songs that sing the laments because they'd have to be in a minor key. And praise hymns are always You know, magnify, for God's sake. Praise hymns are a great recipe for denial. And shame on us. And because the church doesn't want to grieve, it turns grief into guilt. So if something's wrong, it's got to be your fault. A Swedish scholar named Lindstrom has observed that there is very little guilt in the Book of Psalms. I've been teaching Presbyterian students, and in my Psalms class, I always had them exegete one lament psalm, and I began to notice they all did 51 all the time. They love 51 because they're Presbyterians. So much sin to confess. So then I made the assignment, exegete a lament psalm, anything but 51. There are so-called seven penitential psalms. That's traditional. But if you read those seven, they're not much guilt even in them except for 51. And even 51, after the first 11 verses, moves on to hope and petition. The Bible is not so much about guilt. The Bible is very much about lament for a world that is being taken away from us. Now, what this prophetic tradition knows is that without God, nothing needs to change. But with God, with this God whose truth is marching on, everything needs to change. And everything is changing. And the prophetic question is whether you will be crushed by it or whether you will go with it. Now, I want to give you the title of a book that has moved me deeply. It is by Martha Nussbaum, who is a big-time intellectual at the University of Chicago. And she has written a book called The Clash Within. She has had a long-term interest in India, so this book is about her research and her interviews in India and her reflection on India about the Muslim-Hindu crisis, and the war that goes on and on and on in Kashmir. And her conclusion is that the clash in India is not between Muslims and Hindus. The clash is between those who can welcome others unlike us and those who can't tolerate it. Her book is an answer to the famous conservative book about the coming clash of civilizations that says there's a coming war between the Christian West and the Muslims. And Nussbaum's stunning conclusion on the last page of the book is that the clash is within. Here's this big-time intellectual at the University of Chicago says that every one of us has an internal clash between wanting a world uninterrupted by the others and being open to a world that God is, she doesn't say God, is giving us, that is peopled by others unlike us, with whom we must come to terms. So my thought to you is that prophetic ministry is managing the clash that leaves people restless and tired and angry and often aggressive. So my bid to you is take the Friday stuff and take the Sunday stuff that you, as I, believe so deeply and your people all know about and are glad to sing about and affirm, and let the Friday stuff and the Sunday stuff be a map for what's happening in the world at what now is signified for our discipleship in the world. Because Friday has to do with plucking up and tearing down and destroying and overthrowing, which is why there were 3 hours of chaotic darkness that day when chaos pushed against God's governance. And let Easter Sunday be about building and planting the new world. There are many people in your congregation who want to shut down in denial or in despair. And you are the one, as Todd has shown us in the last couple of verses of James, you are the one who practices care that covers a multitude of sins. Because those who practice the dialectic of Friday and Sunday, of tearing down and plucking up and building and planting, of lamenting and praising, they're the ones with freedom, and they're the ones with energy, and they're the ones with boldness who will mount up with wings like eagles and run and not be weary and walk and not faint. So the last verses of 2 Isaiah, in Isaiah 55, 6 following, that you know very well, seek the Lord while he may be found. Turn from your wicked ways, for the mercy of God is beyond your imagination. I have come to think that that summons to the people of God in exile is not a generic call to worship, but what it is an invitation for these Jews to return home to their faith after they had almost forgotten their faith in the midst of the Babylonian Empire. So prophetic ministry is an invitation for the people of God to return to the Friday, Sunday mystery of which we are almost talked out of by the empire. Because the empire does not think a Messiah should die. The empire does not think that a dead man can come back to new life. The empire does not believe in plucking up and tearing down. The empire does not believe in planting and building. And that is the truth that has been entrusted to us. You all be very careful out there.